Lessons Learned in Telling a Family Memoir of Jewish Life in the 20th Century.
I discovered in writing this book that I am descended from a long line of scribes. Not only was my grandfather a scribe, but my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, and my great-great-great-grandfather. And I have come to realize and embrace the fact that I'm a kind of scribe as well. You know, of course, the books that I write are not sacred, but I still feel this sense that I'm carrying on the family work, this sense of the importance of the word, the importance of our history, the importance of our heritage.
That's David Laskin. His book is The Family, Three Journeys into the Heart of the 20th Century. Then, a poet's dialogue with the 1886 Diary of an Ordinary Woman.
I think overall I just felt like here was a woman who was in pretty dire circumstances, and she chose to write in a little book that she probably thought no one would ever read. And she chose to do it anyway. She chose to have a voice. And I think that's what struck me the most about the diary was if she chose to write and have that voice, I wanted to give her more of a stage. I wanted to give her a readership. And then my own dialoguing with the situation in poetry is just, I'm a poet, I'm a writer, and that's what I do. I wanted to go further with it, and that's the only way I knew how to do it.
That's Sarah Sousa. We talk with her about her books, Diary of Esther Small, 1886, and Church of Needles. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Hanukkah began this week. The Jewish Festival of Lights celebrates the survival of a people against overwhelming odds. When the Maccabees defeated the Greeks who had conquered their land, they rekindled the eternal flame that burned in the temple in Jerusalem. But, as every Jewish child knows, there was only enough oil to burn for one day. Yet, miracle of miracles, it burned for eight, until the oil could be replenished. The stories a people tell about themselves is like that eternal flame, illuminating the bright sinews of tradition that bind a people to their soul. For the Jewish people, the stories inscribed in the Torah and Talmud kept that soul alive through centuries of persecution. My guest, David Laskin, comes from a long line of Torah scribes. A writer himself by trade, he pays homage to his forefathers and foremothers in his wonderful memoir, The Family. Beginning in the shtetls of Eastern Europe, his beautifully told tale follows three branches of his family, three iconic stories of Jewish life in the turbulent 20th century. One branch went to New York, where his great-aunt founded the Maiden Form Bra Company. Another branch went to Palestine, where they created a new land of hope for them, but at terrible cost to those they displaced. The third branch perished in the Nazi Holocaust. Only one survived. The Family is a deeply personal account of people caught in a cataclysmic time in world history, one that changed the world of their ancestors forever. David Laskin is the author of four other books, including The Children's Blizzard. The Family won the 2014 Washington State Book Award for Best Memoir. Well, David Laskin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Lovely to be here.
I loved this book, The Family, Three Journeys into the Heart of the 20th Century. It's a superbly told tale about the three branches of your family, each of which seems to have played out a different classic story about Jewish life in the last century, making it in America, pioneering in Israel, and perishing in the Holocaust. Where does this story of this family start?
I pick up the story in the middle of the 19th century. So I start with my great-great-grandfather. His name was Shimon Dov HaKohen. HaKohen is Hebrew for the priest, and he was a Kohen, which is the priestly caste, and he was also a scribe. So he was somebody who copied the Torah onto parchment. So he's the farthest back I went, and he really was the progenitor of this family that, as you mentioned, in succeeding generations, and I trace pretty much from him all the way to the present, but I focus on the generation of my grandparents, that's who the book is really about, those succeeding generations split up, and they took three different paths. And as you mentioned, one came here to the U.S., went into business, and my great aunt, known to the world as Ida Rosenthal, we called her Idle, was the founder of the Maidenform Bra Company. Another branch went to what was then Palestine as Zionist pioneers, and those who remained perished in the Holocaust. So I basically, the story, the book really traces my family, this is my mother's family, from about the 1870s through World War II and through the deaths of the relatives in the Holocaust. And that's the essence of the book.
And what an amazing story it is. It's set in the Pale of Settlement. Tell us why that has that name. Where was it? And talk a little bit, give us a setting. Talk a little bit about what kind of a society this shtetl society was.
So the Russian Pale of Settlement is, or was, the western fringe of the Russian Empire. Now you have to kind of think back to pre-Russian Revolution, pre-World War I. Russia had huge holdings in Europe. So a lot of countries that are now independent countries, Poland, Lithuania, Estonia, Ukraine, Latvia, I'm probably leaving something, oh, of course, Belarus and Lithuania, were all part of Russia then, part of the Russian Empire. And the Tsars decreed that the only place that Jews could live in their Russian Empire was what they called the Pale of Settlement. So the expression beyond the pale comes from that. So this was the western fringe, and they confined the Jews to these regions, and it became very crowded. The Jews were not able to own land. They were forced to live in towns. So your Jewish listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the word shtetl, but maybe some Gentile listeners are not. And shtetl just means small town, and that's the Yiddish word for the small towns where Jews lived in the Pale of Settlement. And, you know, I think inevitably we think of Fiddler on the Roof, the little houses made of wood, the muddy streets, the cow in the backyard. And there is a certain amount of truth to that. You know, it's slightly cliched and sentimental. But I actually went there. When I was researching the book, I went to Belarus and Lithuania and visited the shtetls that my family came from. And I was surprised by a couple of things. First of all, I kind of was expecting them to be very dreary and muddy and, you know, kind of run down and poor. Poor they were, there's no doubt. Poor they were, poor they are. But Rakov in particular, which is the shtetl that my grandfather grew up in and left when he was a teenager, is beautiful. It's at least it was in the spring, very full of gardens. I mean, there's kind of an agricultural side to Jewish town life that I think many of us overlook, in that most of them lived in houses and they had to have vegetable gardens and cows often to, you know, help feed their families. So there was a little bit of rural quality even in these towns. But for the most part, the Jews who lived in the Pale of Settlement worked in trades, cobblers, tailors, shopkeepers, millers, carpenters, things like that. So that's the Russian Pale of Settlement, and it was a world of poverty, but also closeness and tradition. And that, kind of going back to Fiddler on the Roof, that sense of tradition was already beginning to break down before the Russian Revolution. But once the revolution came in 1917, that whole world basically kind of splintered. The Pale ceased to be part of Russia. Religion diminished in importance. And, you know, in many ways, the end of World War I and the violence that endured and afflicted that region set the stage for World War II. So when we think about the Holocaust, we no longer use the word Russian Pale Settlement because it was now splintered into different countries, but that was basically where most of the killing took place. Weaver, the Yale historian, has written a wonderful book called Bloodlands, basically talks about how destructive both communism and Nazism were to the populations of the Pale of Settlement. And I think Bloodlands is another term for that same region, even more graphic in describing its later history.
There were two brothers who play a very important role in this book, the kind of pater familias, Avraham Akiva and Shalom Tzvi. Tell us a bit about both of them.
So Avraham Akiva was my great-grandfather, and he was a Torah scribe. He was the oldest son, so he was, you know, back in those days, that was a big deal. He was really the head of the family, the patriarch, as he got older. Had many children, including my grandfather, and, you know, was a very, very moral, upright man. He was learned. He was respected in the community. He taught Torah. But he was also a very open-minded and flexible man. He immigrated to the U.S. in 1909 and brought all the family together, some of his children, including Idle, the maiden founder, had already come to the U.S. before him. But they all came together and lived in his small cold water flat on the Lower East Side. And, you know, it was very important for him to keep the family together. And he continued his work as a Torah scribe. But at some point, three of his sons went into business together. And that became the family business known as Akon and Sons. So that was the business that was founded in honor of him. And his name in the old country is Avraham Akiva. But here in the States, he became Abraham Cohen. And the business was named for him. And that really sustained the family. So that's his life in a nutshell. He had a younger brother named Shalom Tzvi. And Shalom Tzvi is really the pivotal character in my book. And let me explain why. So Shalom Tzvi had three daughters. One of them was Doba, and she got married and lived in Vilna. One of them was Edel, and she got married and stayed in Rakov. And one of them was Sonia, the youngest, and moved to what was then Palestine. So Shalom Tzvi, as I said at the outset, my book is about the three branches of my family. So Shalom Tzvi, he's the head of the branch that stayed, that remained in Europe. And so the Holocaust victims were really his offspring. But he also has the branch that his daughter, the branch that goes to Palestine and that founds that branch of the family. And fascinatingly, Shalom Tzvi, in 1939, right before the war started, Shalom Tzvi decided to come to the U.S. to visit his brother, Avraham Akiva, or Abraham Cohen, as he was known. So he leaves Poland, he sails to Ellis Island, he arrives in New York, and 2 months later, the war starts. So now he is trapped in the U.S., separated from his family, and has no idea what is happening to them during the war. So now, with his voyage to the U.S., he has basically bridged or straddled all three branches of my family. The Polish branch that was killed in the war, the branch that ended up in Israel and was among the founding families of Israel, and the branch in the U.S., my family. And, you know, there's a lot in the book about him. I have many photos of him. I have many letters that he wrote. So I really delve into his psychology, his tragedy, his trauma of being in this country and suffering in agony without knowing what's happening in Europe, but fearing the worst.
Yeah, he's both a tragic and a lucky figure.
Well, yes, he was lucky in that he escaped. But, you know, you have to question how lucky he felt to escape with his own life. But I don't want to give too much away for readers who are not familiar with the book. But many of his family, closest family members, were killed.
Right. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with David Laskin about his wonderful book. It's called The Family, Three Journeys into the Heart of the 20th Century. So now the American part of the family, it really starts with Itel, who you've talked about, the founder of Maiden Form Bra.
Right.
She started out as a revolutionary, as
yes.
did her husband, and that was back in the old country. I think this is a familiar story, actually, of revolutionary youth in Russia, burning with ideals, come to America and end up in business.
Right. And yes, you're absolutely right, Francesca, that this is surprisingly common. And, you know, for me, it was a little hard to get my head around. Like, how can you vote for the socialist candidate, and how can you be part of the Bund, which is the Jewish Revolutionary Socialist Organization, and then go on and make a killing on Madison Avenue selling brassieres? But, you know, back in those days, they really didn't consider that so contradictory. I think it's interesting now, our politics have shifted so much, but the, you know, the Ellis Island generation, this generation of, for the most part, working class Eastern and Southern Europeans who came over, I would say, between the 1880s and World War I. So in that period of, you know, massive immigration, many of them were socialists. I mean, they are, you know, when you read the immigrant press, not just Jews, but Italians, Poles, Slovaks, Russians, even Irish to some extent, very left-wing, very concerned with workers and their rights. And so Idle was typical of her generation, maybe a little more politically conscious, certainly more politically involved. I mean, she was always a joiner. She was a little bit of a rabble-rouser. But I think that same spirit of social justice and leadership and charismatic, you know, magnetic quality that went into her political life also made her a dynamic boss and a great leader of a company. I mean, she was an early feminist, you know, before her time. I doubt she would have described herself as a feminist, but she certainly walked the walk, even if she didn't talk the talk. You know, she did it her way. She was very headstrong. You know, she was a 4-foot-11-inch chain smoking immigrant with an accent. A lot of strikes against her. Oh, woman, too. Jewish woman. And yet she went on to found one of the largest family businesses in the world. So she didn't, you know, she didn't let anything hold her back. She had a lot of chutzpah. She had a lot of ambition. And she made her dreams come true. And I don't think, you know, I never talked with her about this. I knew her not well. I saw her as a child a few times. But I never talked politics. I doubt she would have said there was anything contradictory about being a socialist and being the founder of a maiden-form company that, you know, made so much money. It was just all part of the game for her.
There's a wonderful scene you describe in the book where she hasn't yet founded maiden-form, and she goes to ask for the opinion of her brothers and her father. Where should she go? She had been a seamstress, and at this point she had worked her way up to being partner in a dressmaking firm. And so tell us what's happening at that meeting, and what was the advice she got, and then what did she do?
So maiden-form, you know, she was just starting to make the transition from dresses to brassieres. And I need to set the scene a little bit, because this is the early 1920s. It's the flapper era, and women, you know, had this sort of boyish silhouette of, you know, you weren't supposed to show off your breasts. In fact, you were supposed to squash or flatten your breasts. And they had these, you know, various kinds of underwear to bind them and hide them. And Idle was like, no, this is ridiculous. You know, women, this is not natural. So she invented this brassiere called maiden-form later that enhanced and supported this part of female anatomy. And it was a hit. Women liked it. And even though it flew a little bit in the face of fashion of the day, it caught on. It was kind of flying off the shelves. And Idle was thinking, hey, you know, maybe I should switch and go into the bra business and forget about the dresses. You know, put all my resources and all of my capital into brassieres. So she had a meeting with her brothers, who were in business, as I mentioned earlier, my grandfather and his two brothers, and her father. And, you know, they heard her out and they said, nah, this is just a gimmick, this brassiere thing. It's just a little fly-by-night kind of novelty item, and it's never going to last. So be conservative, stay with the dresses, don't put your money on the bras. And Idle, being Idle, did it her way, did not take that advice. I'm not even sure why she asked for the advice, because she was always going to do it the way she wanted to do it. But she thanked them, went home, made her own decision, basically killed the dress business, put all of her resources into bras, and the rest is history.
Yeah, that's great. She was the first female tycoon in history, in American history, is that right?
I'm not sure I would claim that. I mean, there were other women of the day, Helena Rubinstein, you know, of that makeup line, I guess. I think there were a couple of others who were of her generation who also made fortunes. But let's say she was in the company of those pioneer women tycoons.
Yeah, she's really amazing. Now, she wasn't the only woman who had gumption, chutzpah, and courage. There was also Sonia, but before we talk about Sonia, we have to talk about Chaim. This is the other part of the family that went to Palestine back in the 1920s, which I think maybe a lot of people don't know, but that was a fairly common thing. Well, maybe not common, but there were a lot of Jews from the Pale who made what they called made Aliyah, went to Palestine in the interwar period. So tell us about Chaim and describe why did they go there?
So Chaim, the year is 1924. Chaim is 18 years old. He's my grandfather's first cousin and Idel's first cousin. So, it, you know, as I said before, this is, book is basically about the generation of the first cousins of my grandfather. And Chaim was very wildly idealistic, and his ideal was to go back to the Holy Land as a pioneer. He was a Zionist. And this was, as you said, very common. This Zionism, this desire to go back to Palestine and to found the Jewish state, this was sweeping Eastern Europe in the years after World War I. It just became this popular movement based on, well, really the oppression that Jews had suffered for so many hundreds of years in Europe, a sense of nationalism, a sense of pride, a sense that this was possible. Theodor Herzl was, you know, kind of among the first to espouse Zionism, and it really caught on. So Chaim could have come to the U.S. I mean, his other cousins did, and he could have gotten a job at Akon & Sons or Maidenform. I mean, those were family businesses which were already up and running at that time. But no, Chaim decided he was going to go to Palestine, and not to pray, not to be a Torah scribe the way his father and grandfather and, you know, other male ancestors had been, but to be a farmer. And that was key to Zionism in the 1920s. Most of the majority of Jews who made Aliyah, who went up to the Holy Land back then, were secular Jews who really went in order to work the land. And some of them were farmers, some of them were road builders, some of them were laborers, but they basically felt it was very important for Jews to provide their own labor and their own, especially farms, agricultural settlements, collective farms in Palestine, to really found a state based on their own toil. So that was Chaim, you know, was a kid. I mean, when I think about 18, young kid, and there's some pictures of him in the book. He was kind of scrappy, a little cocky, had a little bit of an attitude, but he made it happen. And he fell in love with what became Israel, and he was just a great fit. He loved to dance. He loved to sing. He worked hard and never looked back.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with David Laskin about his book, The Family, Three Journeys into the Heart of the 20th Century. And then his first cousin, Sonia, moved there. They fell in love. But, you know, it's not, as we know, this was a fairly complicated thing that happened. Basically, you had one group of people who were fleeing persecution who came and displaced another group of people. You have a really amazing paragraph. You're writing this, there is a dance that happens, a very joyful dance, you know, after some hard-won work, a season there in Palestine. You say, the tragedy of modern Palestine was that one oppressed, thwarted people had come to settle among and inevitably to displace another oppressed, thwarted people. Since they didn't find a way to live together, they lived separately until one was large and strong and determined enough to oppress the other. I just wonder, I don't know where you stand on this, but I know for those of us, Jews and non-Jews, who are deeply disturbed by what Israel has become, you know, a brutal occupying power. It was very interesting to read how this conflict developed out of idealism and hope and persecution. What were some of your thoughts?
Well, very similar to what you just said. You know, when you immerse yourself in Zionist history, you see a couple of things. You see that it really was a movement based on idealism. You see that there's nothing in early Zionism that was anti-Arab, that would have said, let's kick out the Arabs, or let's take their land, or let's occupy their territory. In fact, a lot of the early Zionists were socialists, and they tried to or hoped to make common cause with Arab laborers. We're workers of the world. We're oppressed people. We're on the same page. But I think one of the tragedies, and Ari Shavi talks about this in his excellent book, My Promised Land, is this sense of blindness that I think the Jews came to Palestine, and you read the early accounts, and they will say, there was nothing there. It was a wasteland. It was empty. They somehow didn't see that there were Arab farms, that there were Arab villages. They saw desert. They saw barrenness. They didn't see or didn't allow themselves to see that this was somebody else's ancestral home. And even though, for the most part, the land was purchased legally and settled legally, nonetheless, the people who sold the land were not the peasant farmers. It was the rich owners, many of whom were Arabs themselves or Turks or Egyptians. But the people who lived on and worked the land were Arabs, Palestinians. And so I think this all got going in a way that had tragic consequences. I think this blindness, this feeling that they could come to a country which they considered empty and buy it and settle it with no consequences, was proved to be tragically misguided. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the subsequent history of this region comes out of that. And as, you know, in the early days, the Jews were vastly outnumbered by the Arab population. And they were quite, you know, they were really kind of a marginal group. And there were uprisings and there were riots. And every time something like that happened, the Jewish community felt threatened and they rallied around. And I think gradually their position hardened. And, you know, I don't need to go into the whole subsequent history, but, you know, I think the occupation, there is a direct line that I think we can draw from the first hopeful, idealistic settlements to what's going on today. And, you know, I have very complicated feelings about Israel. I love Israel. I love my relatives. I love being there. But I find it very, very disturbing politically.
Well, there's much more to this book, David Laskin. It's a terrific read. I mean, we haven't even touched on the Holocaust and what happened to that branch of the family. But we'll have to leave that to our listeners to go out and get your book to find out what happened and how that happened. I just have one last question.
Yeah.
Did this book change in any way the way you saw yourself?
Oh, definitely. I discovered in writing this book that I am descended from a long line of scribes. Not only was my grandfather a scribe, but my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, and my great-great-great-grandfather. And I have come to realize and embrace the fact that I'm a kind of scribe as well. You know, of course, the books that I write are not sacred, but I still feel this sense that I'm carrying on the family work, this sense of the importance of the word, the importance of our history, the importance of our heritage, both recording it and passing it down. So I would say researching and writing about my family, discovering the scribal tradition, has definitely changed everything about how I see myself and my own career, and what I hope to pass on to future generations as well.
Well, we're also glad that you did that. The book is The Family. three journeys into the heart of the 20th century. Thank you so much, David Glaskin, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
My pleasure. It was a wonderful interview.
David Glaskin is the author of 5 books. In addition to The Family, they include The Children's Blizzard and The Long Way Home. Read an excerpt from The Family at writersvoice.net. Next up, Sarah Souza explores the found diary of a 19th century housewife through poetry. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When the world saw the video of Janae Rice knocked out cold in an elevator by her husband, NFL player Ray Rice, it seemed that a national conversation about domestic violence might begin. One has begun about police violence against unarmed black men, one long overdue that declares Black Lives Matter. But I'm still waiting for a movement against domestic violence that declares women's lives matter too. The voices saying that are just beginning to be heard. But seldom does the voice of an abused woman come down to us from the shadows of the past. Yet that's just what happened when poet Sarah Souza found an ancient diary at a tag sale, the diary of Esther Small from 1886. Small was an ordinary woman, except perhaps that she might have had a bit more education than the norm. But that was no matter. She was condemned, like so many others, to a life of domestic drudgery and abuse at the hands of her husband. Sarah Souza is a poet and a collector of women's diaries from the 19th century. Those diaries, and especially that of Esther Small, inspire some of her work, especially her persona poems, poems that speak in the voices of characters, real or imagined. In this way, Souza gives voice to the voiceless through her poetry. We spoke with her about 2 books. The Diary of Esther Small, 1886, contains both Small's actual diary entries, as well as Souza's reaction to them. Church of Needles is Souza's first poetry volume. It too contains poems written about Small and her husband, yet stands alone as an extraordinary collection of poetry that sears with a powerful, simple voice. Sarah Souza writes and teaches poetry in Western Massachusetts. Her work has appeared in the Massachusetts Review, the Barn Owl Review, and Salt Hill Journal, among others. She's been nominated 2 for the Pushcart Prize. Church of Needles won the 2013 Red Mountain Prize and was published by Red Mountain Press in 2014. Her second collection, Split the Crow, will be published in 2015 by Freeverse Editions. Well, Sarah Souza, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I was quite taken with this book, The Diary of Esther Small, 1886. In the spring of 2008, you discovered a small diary, and it had the date of 1886, in an antique shop in Maine. Give us a setting. What led you to pick up this diary, and what led you to take it home?
Well, I'm a history buff, and I owned a couple diaries from the 1920s from a family friend. So I was always on the lookout for ephemera, I guess, letters and diaries. It was a little 3x5 diary that would fit in your palm, kind of a faux leather covering. And it was on a table with some other small items. And I think the price was $8, and so why not? I picked it up. I don't think I read anything in the store itself. I just grabbed it and figured I'd look later.
And when you did look later, what were your feelings?
I think I deciphered a few entries, and they weren't the entries that had any abuse or violence in them. They were about the weather and churning butter and the other chores. And I think I put it away until later. And at one point, I did decipher an entry where it appeared she was being abused. And at that point, my interest was piqued, and I continued, and I transcribed all of them.
And you put them out on the page in the form of poetry, but you're just transcribing them, is that right? They're not actually in the form of poems.
No, the entries themselves I transcribed. I tried to stay true to the page, so they're tiny. They look like little lyric poems because they're true to the small 3x5 pages. I then went on and dialogued with the situation and with Esther in poems because I'm a poet, and those are separate from the entries.
Right, and in a moment I'm going to ask you to read one of them, but first tell us a little bit about Esther Small herself. Who was she?
Well, at the time of the diary, she was 42 years old. She was living in rural Maine with her husband, William, who was born in the town where they were living in. She, however, was born in Sandy Creek, New York, which is upstate in Oswego County. It seemed that she married about 28 years old, met William in Sandy Creek. Census records show that he was a tanner and living in Sandy Creek at that time. And I believe that all of her children were born in Maine because some of the first children died in infancy and they're buried in the town where she lived out her life. Her father was a clergyman. I believe she had four siblings. And she was educated through high school, and she studied languages. She seemed to be a literate woman, but I don't know much more about her life than what's in the diary, and that's a year of abuse and hardship.
But you did do some research into Esther Small, and you discovered some things about her. Tell us what you found out.
Well, at the time of the writing of the diary, she was pregnant with her last child, a daughter named Anna. She doesn't write about that in the diary. She doesn't mention that she's carrying a child. She does depict the abuse by her husband. William was a Civil War veteran. He had served a few years in the Civil War in two Maine regiments, and he left his regiment just a few months before the end of the war because of some kind of injury, and I'm not sure what it was. I never found that. I have another diary of Esther's, but it's scantly written in, from 1880, and she does talk about her father-in-law throwing a knife at her but missing. So I believe that it was a hard family. I think she had a hard life. I don't know why she married William. She married him late, maybe. She felt it was time to get married and just wanted to marry. So I don't know. I don't know beyond those two diaries. She did birth seven children, and only four lived to adulthood.
And then you found out that you actually had a personal connection, that you lived in the house of her doctor.
Yes, the doctor who signed her death certificate, she died of heart disease, built and lived in a home that I lived in for a couple years. I believe he had his medical office in his home. She likely didn't visit his office. They were a town apart, but with, you know, horse and wagon, it would have been a longer ride. So he probably did house visits. And yes, he signed her death certificate. And that was an interesting find.
Yeah, personal connection. That must have given you a bit of a shiver.
Yeah, that I was the one who found the diary.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you've mentioned the abuse a couple of times. Tell us about how she talks about this in her diary. How Esther Small talks about it in her diary of 1886.
Well, she's very explicit. She uses the swear words that William throws at her. And she just really lists all of it. In the diary, he only physically abuses her once. He kicks her, but he's verbally abusive quite a bit. He threatens to split her head open and wishes she was dead. He's obviously not a happy man, and he's making her miserable as well. And she's also very homesick throughout the diary. She talks about being so homesick she has to cry, or being so tired that she just has to cry. When I discovered that she was pregnant, it also made more sense, her bone weariness. You know, she's hauling water and taking care of the lambs and the pigs and the chickens, and plus her children, and cooking and dealing with her husband's verbal abuse and sometimes physical abuse, so that it made more sense. But I found it interesting that she talks about being homesick, and it would have been over 10 years since she'd lived with her family. So I think that's telling about how sad she was.
Do you have a copy of the book there?
I do.
On page 88, you refer to that entry you just talked about when her husband kicks her. I wonder if you could read that entry and then tell us about your comment about it, because I found that very interesting.
This morning, while I was doing up the work, William got mad, put off up to Ed Morse's, stayed all the forenoon playing cards. He came home mad, and his father commenced at him about what I had said to him, and it was all a lie. It made William all the madder, and he up and kicked me a few times as hard as he could on my bottom. It hurt so I could not set down unless I had a cushion. Commenced to break out the roads after the storm.
Yeah, it's hard to read. I mean, it's very vivid. You did a very close reading of that, and of the whole diary, but I found that a very interesting process. To kind of eavesdrop on your process, tell us a little bit about how you responded to that poem and how you read it.
Well, I think the most interesting part as far as writing in this entry was the last line, commenced to break out the roads after the storm. I don't know, it was just so poetic, and it was almost like a metaphor for, you know, there's just violence in it, the breaking, there's the storm, you know, the emotional storm and the physical storm that she had just gone through. So I think it was just the way that she ended it, and it's just so straightforward, and it doesn't really refer to what was happening. And it's also the way that she maybe had to shake off the violence that happened to her throughout the entry. She just ends it kind of like breaking away from that emotional pain towards something that's more concrete, with the men actually going out and, you know, physically breaking that snow out of the roads.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Sarah Sousa about her book, The Diary of Esther Small, 1886, as well as her poetry. You also talk about how she addresses the reader from time to time. And of course, now we're the reader, but you were the first reader in this process. You actually wrote a poem, Letter to Esther, after reading her diary. So I wonder if you could read that, including the quote from the diary at the top.
Letter to Esther after reading her diary. Tonight, received a box of things from my brother Warren, with lots in it for me and the children. Also, some few things in it for William. This diary in the box. Esther Small, 1886. All winter, William commenced at you, the way snow and wind commenced, the way men commenced to break out roads after storms. Trouble started every time he walked through the door. New York whore, bloody whore, liar. You had 4 weeks of wash waiting, the delicates and the flannels, got through a little past noon, and no time for his accusations. You seldom wrote, with the lambs, chicks, and piglets to feed, 2 hours to get the butter up, supper to fix, done a little of everything, 3 children plus the one waiting to be born. You wrote not a word of your condition, only William threatened to split my head open again. I have a photo of the 32nd, Maine's contribution to the Civil War. By that time, half the regiment was dead or back home, minus limbs, pieces of skull. William, barely 20, hadn't found you yet in Sandy Creek. I can't quit studying the dirty faces. Is he the one in torn overalls, a wad of chew bulging from his lower lip? The broad, handsome one? The one with delicate features, dark hair? Just tell me he's not the one with crazy eyes, a woman could feel desperate alone with at night.
Yeah, I mean, you surmise that he was suffering from PTSD because he was wounded. So you also have a sense that there might be a larger person behind that, but also a larger person behind the fact of Esther's abuse. I mean, you don't want to define her simply by that, and yet it's such a salient part of this book. Could you talk about your drive to create a balance and your own sense of balance in how you receive her, if we can talk about a literary reception here?
Yes. Yeah, I didn't want to depict her simply as an abused woman, as I only know her through, you know, 1.5 diaries, I'll say, because the 1880 diary is so scantily written in. So I didn't want to just claim that she was an abused woman and then discovering that she had been educated and that she obviously had strong ties with her family. She was a human being, and I think the diary is a sad year in her life, and maybe William had been abusive for many years, but there must have been some point at which they were in love and she loved him, or else why would she have married him? So I wanted that balance, and she comes through in the diary also with some spunk. You know, she's sarcastic at some points, and she obviously has fight, and there was something in that. I think overall I just felt like here was a woman who was in pretty dire circumstances, and she chose to write in a little book that she probably thought no one would ever read, and she chose to do it anyway. She chose to have a voice, and I think that's what struck me the most about the diary was if she chose to write and have that voice, I wanted to give her more of a stage. I wanted to give her a readership. And then my own dialoguing with the situation in poetry is just, I'm a poet, I'm a writer, and that's what I do. I wanted to go further with it, and that's the only way I knew how to do it.
You said in an interview that I found online that you're inspired by history and historical voices, and you say that you're obsessed by the persona poem and can't help taking on the voices of other women and oppressed populations. I think you've really done that in this book, The Diary of Esther Small. And it's not just her diary. There's also an extended comment at the end. I found a poem in your wonderful collection, The Church of Needles, that seemed to me to express some of this approach. Not to history per se, but to achieving the balance. It's called Integrate the Shadow. I just love this poem, as I loved many in this volume. I wonder if you could read that.
Sure. Integrate the Shadow. Learn the coyote's song, the deceptively domestic dog bark, meant to lure, ending with communal war cry. Chain yourself to a tree. Dig a hole on the spot and claim it. Embody submission while burning the black off your thin kettle of rage. Force yourself to take human beauty lightly. It galls. It ages. Make yourself an ode to beauty. You'll have to use the word shriven, the word bitter. See life stripped of memory's gloss. To framed photos, apply the hammer. Surrender your collection of birds' nests. Admit you had evicted the tenants. Admit your disgust for the strange gray strands woven with your own. Name your tolerance. Name your shame. The way you shove your head under the dark surface without a prayer going down or coming up. Claim your fear, your flirtation with disaster. Walk your terror on a frayed rope, as seldom as you walk the black dog. Let your terror grow restless. Let it pace the house. Snack from the mousetrap, share the bed. Give your terror a name. Speak the name in empty rooms. Persuade it to respond.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Sarah Sousa about her book, The Diary of Esther Small, 1886, and other poetry. I could almost imagine you writing this poem that you just read us also to Esther Small.
Oh, yes, I can kind of see that now. I didn't mean it at the time.
So could you say a little bit about this poem? I mean, I'm always a little hesitant to ask poets to explain their poetry, so I'm not going to ask you to interpret it, but maybe just tell us where you're coming from when you were writing it.
I'm going to try to remember it. This book spans, you know, over probably 5 years or so, and this is, you know, from around 2005, so not this poem specifically, but the entire collection starts then, so it is kind of hard to call things up. I can say about Integrate the Shadow that As with a lot of poetry, it's not, I can't point to parts of it and say it's about this, but it's a feeling, and I think that's what comes across, is it's that, it's kind of a despair, you know, when you get to that point where you're very low, and it's kind of, actually, it reminds me a little bit of Esther's attitude in some of her entries where she's a little bit sarcastic, where it's, you know, well, if things are going to be so bad, then I'm just going to court disaster and, you know, I'll call it out. If there's nothing else to do, I'll call out the shadow and we'll have it out right now and we'll just get it over with.
Well, Integrating the Shadow is also part of becoming a whole person.
Yeah.
You know, you did a lot of research into 19th century diaries when coming out with the book, The Diary of Esther Small, 1886. These were diaries of working class women. And I found it interesting that they seemed to balance the outward and the inward, maybe the sunlight and the shadow as well. And maybe that was a new thing, balancing the personal and the quotidian. Could you say a little bit about 19th century working class women's diaries and why are they important?
Yes, I think it was around that time that people in general, but I think women wrote more, started to get more personal in the diaries. Before that point, a lot of them were like ledgers or family, you know, they were for the family. And sometimes mothers and daughters would write back and forth to each other. Abigail and Louisa May Alcott did that. So it was around this time that I think women began to write more about what was happening inside. And you still don't see a lot of it. I mean, if you go through 19th century diaries in general, you'll see a lot of weather, a lot of copious record keeping of the weather and the chores, but this was part of their lives. But then those moments would creep in, like I said in the book, where a woman would say, you know, some just despair would jump out, you know, how homesick she was or how exhausted she was or heartbroken. It never took over the entry. These were small diaries anyway, and I don't think women had much time to write. So it was like it was jotting it down, almost like the weather, just to remember, you know, on this day, that they were exhausted or despairing. And I think it was just a way to get it out. Maybe they couldn't express some of these things to the people in their lives, their husbands or friends, and it was just a way to get it out and to express it, even if it was in a private diary.
And, you know, I just remembered that you wrote at least two other poems to Esther. Well, there's another one to Esther. Esther, September 8th, 1866. And you wrote one about a tanner who was in the Civil War, so I assume that that was William. The one to Esther, September 8th, 1866, is very different from the other one. Could you read that as well? That's on page 44.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll read it first, and then I can answer questions or explain it a little bit. Esther, September 8th, 1866. We met today on the banks of the Severn River, where a woman drowned last year collecting blossoms from a chestnut tree. I left grandmother nodding in the parlor, Julia hosting the crochet club. We gave alms to the swollen river, trees leaning above the water. William said, "I'm like the willows, demure." I let him hold my hand, hid my smile in a hanky. Before today, the darkness and lingering illness pressed heavily. Unburden my spirit, I prayed, knowing my prayer should be more weight. He came to me as a butterfly settles, startling, persistent, And when he unfurled the itchy wool from my knees, my hands grasped to hold or ease the fall.
So this is a very different sense of their relationship. Is this something imagined or something taken from the diary that inspired you?
This one is much more imagined. There's more poetic license happening here. This was part of the dialogue that I was having with the diary and with the whole situation. So I imagined it as an entry, and this would have been around the time that they had met and were dating. I wanted to imagine, the courtship, that there was a time when, you know, he was courting her and when she was falling in love with him and he wasn't an abuser. I just don't think that it could have been different. I would be really even sadder if it were, if she never loved him and married him for other reasons. I felt like this would flesh out the story and round it out in a way to imagine this time. And yeah, so it's mostly poetic license, because as far as I know, she didn't have an illness, but it's poetry, which is close to fiction. So,
You talk about creating your own poetry of witness. Say more about that.
I think that I've discovered that writing the persona poem, which is pretty much writing a poem in another person's voice, taking on, you know, kind of like having a character in a book, a fictional character. You take on their voice and you say something in it. I tend to choose women, you know, oppressed women, women who didn't have a voice at the time that they were living and in their lives, and then I write something in their voice. For me, I've discovered that it's a poetry of witness. It's a way of giving voice to a population or an individual who didn't have a voice in their time, or wasn't heard, or had a voice, you know, said things, wrote things, but wasn't really heard. And I think poetry of witness can be a lot of things, and some people in contemporary poetry, it's political, you know, it's about what's contemporary, but I write about historic things, and so that is my poetry of witness. It's historic, it's populations that have passed, and maybe their political situations have passed, but I still feel that I'm giving them a voice, even if it's after the fact.
And not unconnected from contemporary voices. I mean, you're drawing a line from the past to the present.
Yes, and, you know, abuse is current and contemporary as well. So, yes, it's giving an abused woman or a woman who was abused for a period of time a voice, a greater voice.
Well, you're a wonderful poet, Sarah Sousa. You're coming out with another book, is that right?
Yes, it's either late this fall or early in the winter. The title is Split the Crow, and it will be out on Parlor Press.
Wonderful. I look forward to talking with you more about that when that comes out. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about the diary of Esther Small, 1886, as well as Church of Needles.
Thank you, Francesca.
Sarah Sousa. Her poetry volume, Church of Needles, won the 2013 Red Mountain Prize and was published in 2014. Her second collection, Split the Crow, will be published in 2015. You can read two poems by Sousa by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.